From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, the 41st installment of our ongoing conversation, after a brief, I'd say a month-long hiatus, with Professor Luciana Bone about the history of the Soviet Union, and we're now going to start focusing on what happened, beginning with the Khrushchev period and going up to 1991, and all of the things that happened, leading up to the Yeltsin years. And so, Luciana, I've missed the conversations with you, and let's pick it up where we left off.
I'm very happy to be back, too.
Good.
Me too. I mean, the question for today that we pose is, for our conversation, is why did socialism collapse in the Soviet Union in between 1989-91? So we begin by, or I begin by saying that this event, as most people acknowledge, most sensible people acknowledge, was a catastrophe for the whole world. What followed was exactly what Stalin predicted in 1924. He said that such a collapse of the Soviet Union, would leave particularly the colonial world completely exposed to Western, neo-colonization. At that time, it would have been called just Western colonization, among many other evils. Now, these other evils include, we can see in retrospect, he said it in 1924, but in retrospect, we can say that they include the neoliberal global economic offensive on workers' rights,
right,
now 40 years old. And this has created obscene levels of wealth concentration in few hands and massive global poverty and massive mass migration. This economic war on the world, which we call neoliberal, is accompanied by military wars, ongoing wars on the Middle East, the economic wars and threats of war on Russia and China, the relentless advance by NATO through Eastern Europe to the borders of Russia, and in East Asia, the so far unsuccessful attempts to subvert the democratic People's Republic of Korea, which has borders with both Russia and China. So we can safely argue, I think, that the destruction of the Soviet Union, both from inside, which we will discuss, and outside, has exposed the world to a state of permanent and ultimate threat of nuclear war. So the threat of war to the planet, we can conclude, cannot have been the Soviet Union, because it is now gone. So it is important to determine what were the causes of its destruction, because the reconstruction of the world for peace depends on understanding what happened to socialism in the Soviet Union. So I go on, if I may. Now, what can we discard regarding the causes of this collapse? Now, we can discard the conclusion of Western Sovietologists, because they have vested interests in defaming socialism. These bought Western liquidationists, as I call them, offer the explanation that the USSR was the empire of evil and a totalitarian state. Now, these are meaningless words, because they reflect the bourgeois criminalization of the Soviet Union since its birth in 1917. Now, a significant contribution to this criminalization has been the collaboration of the Western, both radical and reformist left, has been the collaboration of these two, radical and reformist left, in propagating it, especially ever since 1956 with Khrushchev's demonization of Soviet socialism. The Western left has a great deal of responsibility. So we can discard the analysis of bourgeois economists too, because they repeat the tautology that the Soviet Union, quote, collapsed because communist economy cannot function. So now we have to ask, what would be a constructive explanation of why the Soviet Union folded? So I intend to concentrate on the economic problems of Soviet socialism in the 1980s. In that regard, we often hear, without evidence and almost as a cliche, that the Soviet economy was collapsing. But this is false. Even the most attentive anti-communist scholars are ready to admit it. GDP grew in the Soviet Union at much higher levels than Western economies, and grew far more than it is growing today in Europe and the USA. And for specific graphs and facts, I would refer readers to a book I read last summer, Roger Kieran, Thomas Kenny, Socialism Betrayed, Behind the Collapse of the Soviet Union. And they will get there, the specifics, which, you know, perhaps we can go on later on, but this is a general presentation today. So, let me just see. Just 1 second.
Not a problem. I'm looking, meanwhile, through the introduction to the book you just cited, Socialism Betrayed, Behind the Collapse of the Soviet Union.
Yeah, very good book.
And, you know, they talk about, you know, some of the difficulties in doing an analysis of something that happened so recently, on the one hand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as a matter of fact, the process of betrayal is something that was going on almost from the beginning, you know, from 1917. And we've been, you know, having detailed conversations about that process over, you know, over the last year.
And you and I have,
indeed. And so, you know, that is something to keep in mind also. So it is quite possible to chart the path to the collapse.
Yeah, well, contrary, what our conversations sought or maybe succeeded, I don't know, in pointing out is that there was never a monolithic communist party in the Soviet Union. I mean, you don't eliminate classes and class interests just by doing a revolution. Things continue. There are, so within the what we have been saying, I think, is that within the Soviet Communist parties, there were different classes, class interests, as will become obvious if I continue now. You know, the Bolsheviks were, in my opinion, always the minority. Well, I don't want to retrace all our conversation. Let me just go on now. But the Communist Party, contrary to how it's presented in the West, in the Soviet Union, was never a monolith. There were always struggling classes because communism hadn't yet happened.
Right.
And it would, you know, require communism to, at least in theory, to eliminate classes.
Right. And, you know, so, you had a bunch of theory. Let me interrupt for 1 second. The Zilas in Yugoslavia, for example, people that had written about, you know, bureaucrats constituting some new class and, you know, all of that. Mm-hmm. But and, you know, there was a lot of argument back and forth about that. But in fact, it wasn't. That's not a new class. A class is about where you stand in relation to the means of production, if you own it or if it owns you, basically, and if you're an appendage to it. So, and you know, there were many moves that were taken, beginning with the NEP back in the early 20s, and, you know, all the way through, beginning really in earnest in the post-war period with Khrushchev, where capitalism was restored. And there were institutions that were, placed into existence, like Berioska stores in the Soviet Union and in the Eastern Bloc, where some things that were not available in the stores of the Soviet Union because of the economic blockade by the West could be purchased, but only for dollars or marks or other Western currencies. And what would happen is that people who, like the guy who delivers tomatoes to the market in his truck, suddenly would start showing up at the market with an empty truck, sell the tomatoes behind the in-tourist hotel to the Westerners for dollars and marks or whatever, and then go into the Berioska store and buy a Japanese tape recorder or whatever the thing was that they wanted. And there were a variety of things both at the ground level like that and also at the international level with the the IMF and other organizations that allowed borrowing certain types of international commerce with the West, but always under the control of the West, and they used that to create crises when the time was ripe. So anyway, you had all this stuff going on.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So yeah, to continue then, I was saying that the GDP in the Soviet Union actually grew at much higher levels than Western economies, and grew far more than it is growing today in Europe, certainly. What is it in Europe? 1.5?
It's not 7 or 8 or 9%.
No. In Europe and the USA. Now, basic needs such as food, rent, energy were fully satisfied. Unemployment had disappeared. Free and good public services were available to all. Industrial and technological sectors, for goodness sake, first man in space, were often more advanced than capitalist ones. There was a cultural production and an infinitely superior education in quality and popular diffusion than in capitalist countries. I don't have to remind readers who heard me before that, in effect, the Republic of Russia, the Soviet Republic of Russia, was dumped a lot of money in the Asian republics in terms of preserving their culture, right, building libraries, right, having houses of translation, etc., etc.
Right.
So globally, the economy of the USSR was in good health.
Yeah, I mean, the relationship between, say, the Russian Soviet Federated Socialist Republic and, say, Kyrgyzstan or mm-hmm. Uzbekistan or whatever, quite different from the relationship between the United States and, say, Peru or, some place else in the Western Hemisphere, Puerto Rico, for that matter. Way different. And just, you glanced past very quickly, first man in space, et cetera. Okay, April 12th, 1961, Yuri Gagarin goes into outer space. That is less than 16 years after the end of World War II, when the Soviet Union was devastated, suffered 20 million, 30 million dead people, every city shelled for months and months and months and months, half of the economic base destroyed, the other half relocated, and yet they had the first person in space, and that was 5 years after they, or 4 years after they put the first satellite in space.
Yes, and that was, of course, not the Khrushchev legacy. That had
correct.
Been prepared by the former administration.
That's correct.
That Khrushchev took credit for that in his speech, in his secret speech in demonizing Stalin in 1956. But you don't put a man in space in 4 years. That Gagarin was born. How old was Gagarin when he went out into space?
He was born in 1934, so...
There you go.
Yeah, so he was not quite...
Completely
he was 24,
educated.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And in fact, this good health of the economy, which is never acknowledged, was also a good health in the socialist republics of Eastern Europe, which were often more advanced in certain sectors of the economy than in equivalent sectors of the USSR economy. All you have to do is think of East Germany and Czechoslovakia economy. So, yet there was a need for reforms, so they say, and these reforms led to the fall of the system. So what happened? Now, we hear often somewhat semi-rational critiques in the West. For example, they cite the Soviet refusal to innovate by introducing market mechanism. Or they say continuing the NEP, the new economic policy started in the 1920s out of extreme necessity by Lenin, that is a kind of partial, not return, but partial practice of capitalism. Or we hear that they failed to follow the Chinese model, not understanding a thing about the Chinese model because they don't admit what happened really in the Soviet Union, which right. China learned from. Or they say that there is an impossibility of reforming the socialist model itself. So we must specify which aspects of the economy needed reform and weren't reformed. So in 1956, with Khrushchev, the first thing that happened was the ideological rigor, the one that Lenin insisted on and Trotsky objected to, the ideological rigor of the party was loosened. As we mentioned before, it opened up admission to people who hadn't been vetted, who hadn't acted, who hadn't proven action in promoting the proletarian revolution. Anyway, opening of membership to the party. But it, more consequentially, perhaps the competent control over the socialist economy was loosened. Khrushchev, what the new course, they were called the reformists, the new course envisaged a right turn, understood as less centralized planning and more economic liberalism. Now, this didn't apply to all of the economy. It applied to certain sectors. But a good example of a disastrous reform was the disastrous reform of agriculture, which, with the dismantling of the large tractor centers that Stalin had built in favor of an increased autonomy of the kolkhozes, the agricultural cooperatives, for which Lenin had been in favor of and Stalin developed. Now, what happened is that this caused a substantial loss of productivity in agriculture and an increase in prices that generated discontent in the population. In practice, Khrushchev's application of this line was nothing short of catastrophic. Now, Khrushchev lasted from 56 to 64, and even within his years, he had to sideline out of the party the remaining followers of Stalin's policy, naming Molotov, Malenkov, and people like that, who attempted to talk sense to the party after the secret speech, but they were sidelined. However, they prevailed or in removing Khrushchev because the effect on agriculture was devastating and other things. In 1964, he was removed. However, now let's leave aside here the nefarious role of the right-wing opposition, of which Khrushchev was a part, which you said really dates back to Bukharin and to the early years of the revolution, which exploded in the late 1920s in a conflict between St- Stalin, Bukharin, Trotsky, and Stalin won, initiating the socialism in one country and the industrialization of the country. So this right wing was not a novelty. And Khrushchev was the most vocal supporter of Stalin until he died. So so we can ignore the right wing, the nefarious influence or role of the right, of this right wing opposition who took power with Khrushchev in the falsification of Soviet history, of the Stalin period, and the demonization of Stalin himself, which disrupted the communist parties of the world. So, but the least that can be said is that this tendency, this right-wing tendencies, did not, of reform, as they called it, did not take the form of an orderly transition. Yeah. Of a part of the economy toward the market mechanism, in, which might have been included in the five-year plans. There was no plan, and this really hit in the 90s. There was no plan to correlate private investments with macro-public investment, as China does now. Nothing serious was put in place to reform, let alone regulate, that part of the economy, which was opening to market processes. If this was even the authentic desire of those tendencies within the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, which was most... Okay, so that segment of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, which was most conciliatory to the petty bourgeoisie and had been from the beginning, and to the partially capitalist economy represented in Stalin's time by the medium-rich peasantry, of which Khrushchev and the ruling order around him, close to him, were the political representative.
Right.
So what I'm arguing here is, you know, including in what I said, is my, I do feel that being born in a class has some effect in most people, and Khrushchev class was this, and Trotsky's was this medium rich peasantry and Bukharin's. Okay, now the new reformist course did not deal with improving the less well performing sectors of the planned economy, which we can identify in the future. Now these less well, and I've seen all this in Yugoslavia, so I can, you know, compare. These less well-performing sectors of the planned economy began to show cracks and dysfunctions. Because over these, like you said, your tomato, you know, industry, you said, these cracks where the focus of the government was less strict, and these, and so, which we can call unregulated sectors of the planned economy, fell increasingly into private hands. So I want to, in the future, talk about the, what you call it, the camps for vacation and leisure that the Soviet Union had started.
Yes.
Particularly in Crimea and Georgia.
Yeah.
Those were very vulnerable industries. Those were where you can, with sort of real estate industries.
Right.
A lot happened there, and we can look into that more specifically.
You know, you could also, I mean, you know, let me just back out for a second. I'm looking at Socialism Betrayed, okay? And I'm going to read from that. A brief review of the Soviet Union's accomplishments underscores what was lost. The Soviet Union not only eliminated the exploiting classes of the old order, there's no question about that, they did, but also ended inflation, unemployment, racial and national discrimination, all true, grinding poverty, and glaring inequalities of wealth, income, education, and opportunity. All true. In 50 mm-hmm. years, the country went from an industrial production that was only 12% of that in the United States to industrial production that was 80% and agricultural output 85% of the United States. And no society had ever increased living standards and consumption so rapidly in such a short period of time for all its people. And that was true up until China did that over the last two decades. But otherwise, that was it. Employment was guaranteed. Free education available to all, from kindergarten through secondary schools, universities, and after-work schools. Besides free tuition, post-secondary students received living stipends. Free health care existed for all, with about twice as many doctors per person as in the United States. Workers who were injured or ill had job guarantees and sick pay. In the mid-1970s, workers averaged 21 working days of vacation, or a month. Sanitariums, resorts, and children's camps were either free or subsidized, like you were just starting to talk about.
Yeah.
Trade unions had the power to veto firings and recall managers. The state regulated prices and subsidized the cost of food and housing. Rent constituted only 2 to 3% of the family budget. Water and utilities only 4 or 5%. No housing segregation by income. Though some neighborhoods were reserved for senior officials, elsewhere, plant managers, nurses, professors, and janitors lived side by side. The government included cultural and intellectual growth as part of the effort to enhance living standards. State subsidies kept the price of books, periodicals, and cultural events at a minimum. Workers often owned their own libraries. The average family subscribed to at least 4 periodicals. And UNESCO reported the Soviet citizens read more books and saw more films than any other people in the world. And on and on and on. And by the way, yet again, 15 years after the country is practically destroyed and they rebuild it, they put the first human being in outer space.
It's unbelievable. And let's not forget the no more famines, except in 46 as a result of weather and the war, and epidemics curtailed, safe pregnancies, birth rate, increase of lifespan, what do you call it?
Yeah, the life, that's right. Life expectancy,
Yeah, life expectancies, all of which went out with the
The collapse, whatever, the counter-revolution of 1991. Not only that, I'm going to close with this, too. We're like a minute and a half away. So the last point I want to make, and we'll pick it up here next week, is that is just a sketch of the impact that the Soviet Union had on its own people. Here in the United States, which was about as far removed from the influence of the Soviet Union as you could get, at least due to the best efforts of the elites here, after the Soviet Union collapsed, the union membership in the United States was cut in half, from 22% to 10%. And going back to Khrushchev.
Now what is it, 11?
Now it's 11. Back when Khrushchev stopped paying attention, when basically the revisionists came to power in the Soviet Union and there was no longer any expectation that was offered as an alternative model to American workers, then union membership went from 33% at that time in the United States down to, it's now just shy of 11%. That was just one of the rainbow effects of having the Soviet Union and having the Communist Party sit in power in the Soviet Union and having this power of the state and the economy in the hands of the Soviets, which translate that Russian word Soviet into workers' council. That's what we've lost since that happened, and we're going to pick it up there next week, Luciana. Thank you very much.
Very good. Thank you, Don.
Thanks. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.